The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Missy Hollander from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the Ladies' Home Journal, December-January issue. The first article I'm going to read is entitled, The X Factor. The most important thing about me, for a big chunk of my life, was that I was divorced. I have been married to my third husband for more than 20 years now. But when you've had children with someone you're divorced from, divorce defines everything. It's the lurking fact, a slice of anger in the pie of your brain. Of course, there are good divorces, where everything is civil, even friendly. Child support payments arrive. Visitations take place on schedule. Your ex-husband rings the doorbell and stays on the other side of the threshold. He never walks in without knocking and helps himself to coffee. In my next life, I must get one of those divorces. One good thing about divorce is that it sometimes makes you a better wife to your next husband because you have a place for your anger. It's not directed at the person you're currently with. Another good thing is that divorce makes clear something that marriage obscures, which is that you're on your own. There's no power struggle over which of you is going to get up in the middle of the night. You are. But I can't think of anything good about divorce as far as the children are concerned. You can't kid yourself about that, although many people do. They say things like, it's better for children not to grow up with their parents in an unhappy marriage. But unless parents are beating each other up or abusing the children, kids are better off with their parents together. Children are too young to shuttle between houses. They're too young to handle the idea that two people they love most in the world don't love each other anymore, if they ever did. They're too young to understand that all the wishful thinking in the world won't bring their parents back together. And newfangled rigmarole of joint custody doesn't do anything to ease the cold reality. In order to see one parent, the child must walk out on the other. The best divorce is the kind where there are no children. You walk out the door and never look back. That was my first divorce. There were cats I was wildly attached to. My husband and I even spoke in cat voices. Once the marriage was over, I never thought of the cats again until I wrote about them in a novel and disguised them as hamsters. A few months before my first husband and I broke up, I had a magazine assignment to write about the actors Rod Steiger and Claire Bloom and their fabulous marriage. They insisted on being interviewed separately. This should have been some sort of clue, but I was clueless. In fact, looking back, it seems to me that I was clueless until I was about 50 years old. Anyway, I interviewed them in separate rooms of their Fifth Avenue apartment. I wrote the piece. I turned it in. The magazine sent me a check, and a day later, Rod Steiger and Claire Bloom announced they were getting a divorce. I couldn't believe it. Why hadn't they told me? Why had they gone forward with the magazine piece about their marriage when they were splitting up? But then my own marriage ended, and a week later a photographer turned up at my former apartment to take a picture of my husband and me for an article about our kitchen. I wasn't there, of course. I'd moved out. What's more, I'd forgotten the appointment. The reporter assigned to the piece was livid that I hadn't remembered, hadn't told her, and had agreed to do the interview about my marital kitchen when I had to have known I was getting a divorce. But the truth is, you don't always know you're getting a divorce. For years, you're married. Then one day, the concept of divorce enters your head. It sits there for a while. You lean toward it, and then you walk away. You make lists. You calculate how much it will cost. You tote up grievances and pluses and minuses. You start seeing a shrink. The two of you start seeing a shrink. And then you end the marriage, not because anything in particular happened that was worse than the day before, but simply because you suddenly have a place to stay while you look for an apartment, or $3,000 your father had unexpectedly given you. I don't mean to leave out the context. My first marriage ended in the early 1970s, at the height of the woman's movement. Jules Pfeiffer used to draw cartoons of young women dancing wildly around looking for themselves, and that's what we all were like. We took things way too seriously. We drew up contracts that were meant to divide the household tasks in more equitable fashion. We joined consciousness-raising groups and sat in a circle and pretended we weren't jealous of one another. We read tracts that said the personal is political. And by the way, the personal is political, although not as much as we wanted to believe it was. But the main problem with our marriages was not that our husbands wouldn't share the housework, but that we were unbelievably irritable young women and our husbands irritated us unbelievably. My second divorce was the worst kind of divorce. There were two children. One had just been born. My husband was in love with someone else. I found out about his affair when I was still pregnant. I had a meeting in New York with a writer-producer named J. Presson Allen and was about to go to LaGuardia to get my flight home to Washington, D.C., when she handed me a script. "Read this," she said. "You'll like it." I opened it on the plane. It began with the married couple at a dinner party in London. I can't remember their names, but for the sake of the story, let's call them Clive and Lavinia. It was a very sophisticated dinner party, and everyone at it was smart and brittle and chattering brilliantly. Clive and Lavinia were particularly clever, and they bantered with each other in a charming, flirtatious way. Everyone in the room admired them and their marriage. In the middle of dinner, a man seated next to Lavinia put his hand on her leg. She put her cigarette on his hand. The glittering conversation continued. When the dinner ended, Clive and Lavinia got into their car. The talk ceased, and they drove home in absolute silence. And then Lavinia said, "All right, who is she?" That was on page 8 of the screenplay. I couldn't breathe. I knew at that moment that my husband was having an affair. I sat there, stunned, for the rest of the flight. The plane landed, and I went home and straight to his office in our apartment. There was a locked drawer. Of course, I knew there would be. I found the key. I opened the drawer, and there was the evidence, a book of children's stories she'd given him with an incredibly stupid inscription about their enduring love. I wrote about all this in a novel called Heartburn, and it's a funny book, but it wasn't funny at the time. I was insane with grief. My heart was broken. I was terrified about what was going to happen to my children and me. I felt gaslighted, idiotic, and utterly mortified. I walked out dramatically and came back after promises were made. My husband entered the usual cycle for this sort of thing. Lies, lies, and more lies. I myself entered surveillance, steaming open American Express bills, swearing friends to secrecy, and finding out that the friends I'd sworn to secrecy couldn't keep a secret. There was a mysterious receipt from James Robinson Antiques. I called and pretended to be my husband's assistant and claimed I needed to know exactly what the receipt was for so that I could insure the item. It turned out to be an antique porcelain box that said, "I love you truly" on it. It was presumably not unlike the antique porcelain box my husband had bought for me a couple of years earlier that said "forever and ever." I mention all this so you'll understand the process. Once you find out he's cheated, you have to keep finding it out over and over and over again until you've degraded yourself so completely that there's nothing left to do but walk out. When my second marriage ended, I was angry and hurt and shocked. Now I think, of course. I think, who can possibly be faithful when they're young? I think, stuff happens. I think people are careless, and there are almost never any consequences, except for the children, as I've said. And I survived. My religion is get over it. I turned it into a rollicking story. I wrote a novel. I bought a house with the money from the novel. People always say you forgot the pain. It's a cliche of childbirth. You forget the pain. I don't happen to agree. I remember the pain. What you really forget is the love. Divorce seems as if it will last forever, and then suddenly, one day, your children grow up, move out, and make lives for themselves, and except for an occasional flare, you have no contact at all with your ex-husband. The divorce has lasted way longer than the marriage, but finally it's over. Enough about that. The point is that for a long time, the fact that I'm divorced was the most important thing about me, and now it's not. And this article was an excerpt from I Remember Nothing and Other Reflections by Nora Ephron. And that is out in bookstores now. The next article that I'm going to read is entitled Native Tongue. And this article is by Monica Bide, and that is spelled B-H-I-D-E. By the time he was 6, my son Jai had an amazing eating habits. He wasn't afraid to try new foods, and he had a pretty well-developed palate for a kid. "Oh, this mushroom is so different from the shiitakes we had last week," he would say thoughtfully. Or, "It isn't an ice cream when it's like this, Mama. It's a sorbet." I would beam with pride when he could not only name all the vegetables, herbs, and spices in my shopping cart, but would also help me pick out the best fruits by sniffing the melons for ripeness and carefully inspecting the apples for bruises. I often think about how his fearless tastes were shaped. My husband and I are of Indian heritage, and when Jai would travel to India with us, he'd chat with local vegetable vendors in Hindi and try unfamiliar treats like spicy onion rings. Back home in Virginia, he would eat dishes such as traditional Indian rice pudding that connected him with his beloved grandparents. He would ask for seconds of foods that other kids hated, like cauliflower and Brussels sprouts. He knew what he liked, and he wasn't afraid to show it. But his love of food had even deeper roots. From the time he was very young, food was our bond. We often baked together, and he and I would spend hours giggling over spilled milk and broken egg messes. We would ooh and ah over delightful, luscious chocolate cookies. Food connected us. Then Jai started school. When his new friends came over, they'd be curious about his adventurous nature, and sometimes unintentionally poke fun at his eating habits. "Yuck, I can't believe you're eating salmon," or why don't you order pizza like everyone else? Even worse were the well-intentioned parents, who would say things like, "Jai, I wish my son ate like you. Can you show him some of your favorite ways to eat vegetables?" Jai would cringe, just barely, but enough that I could see. The other parents would tell me how lucky I was that I didn't have a picky eater. My poor son would hear this and think that his eating habits made him weird. Slowly but surely, the way Jai ate began to change. He started asking for fries, for white-colored foods like potatoes and rice with no spices, for soda. I could see longing on his face as he looked at the curries on our dinner table, but he would push them away. I was heartbroken. I tried offering him the bland foods he said he wanted, supplementing them with the dishes I knew he loved, yet he shied away from his old favorites. He wanted only what his friends ate. I wondered what I could do to get my adventurous eater back, but I also worried that if I pushed him to eat what he was used to, he would rebel and I would just be adding to the pressure that he was already feeling. The solution came through a story I was writing for the Washington Post about children's cooking classes in my area. I took Jai along for a lesson making sushi. He had never tasted it before and was completely entranced by the stories and the gentle ways of the young chef who was instructing the class. The chef began with a brief introduction of sushi and its condiments, wasabi and ginger, then showed the kids how to assemble the dish. "What fish would you like in your sushi?" he asked. When the kids around the counter replied eel and salmon, I knew that Jai would fit right in. As they ate their creations, Jai spotted a small cup on the counter holding a tiny bright orange ball and pointed to it. "What are these?" he asked. A classmate told him they were fish eggs, observing that each one is like a whole fish. Jai's brown eyes twinkled and he laughed out loud. He ate every single piece of sushi he made that day. I could tell he loved that there were other kids like him who enjoyed different foods and weren't afraid to show it. On the way back home, we snuggled in the cab and admired the beautiful buildings in downtown Washington, D.C. "Mama, I had fun today," he said sweetly. Then he added, "Can you make shrimp curry tonight?" The next article I'm going to read is entitled Animal Rescue. When volunteer firefighter Mark Clark received a dispatch call alerting him that his house was on fire, he thought it was a cruel joke. As reality quickly set in, however, his thoughts flew to Bart, his 13-year-old German short-haired pointer, who was in the basement of his New Brighton, Minnesota home. "I remember saying, 'You've got to tell the guys to let him out,'" Clark says. He arrived on the scene to find his co-workers huddled around Bart, who had accompanied many of them on weekend hunting trips, trying to revive him with human resuscitation equipment. "After about 15 minutes, I told them to stop working," Clark said. It was clear that there was no way to save Bart. The loss was hard not just on Clark, but also on his fellow firefighters, who worried they'd let their good friend down. And there was another person who felt their pain just as acutely, Janet Olson, the wife of one of the firefighters and a devoted animal lover, who was then in veterinary school. Despite a tremendous amount of training and dedication, the firefighters felt helpless because they lacked the skills and equipment necessary to help a pet, Dr. Olson says. "I didn't want any rescuer to experience that again." Dr. Olson finished up her veterinary degree and began to practice, but she never stopped thinking about what had happened to Bart. 8 years after his death, she felt she was finally in a position to do something about it. So in 2004, armed with $5,000 in startup funds from the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Foundation, Olson created BART, Basic Animal Rescue Training. Funded by grants and donations and staffed mostly by volunteers, the nonprofit organization teaches firefighters, EMTs, paramedics and police officers how to administer first aid and CPR to cats and dogs, as well as how to handle larger animals in emergencies. In the past 5 years, BART has certified more than 4,000 firefighters and other first responders who have saved the lives of many animals to the relief of grateful owners. BART instructors, all vets, techs, or veterinary students, teach animal care basics. For instance, the best place to find a dog's pulse is along the inside of the back leg, and handling techniques. After training, fire departments receive an emergency kit packed with gear such as cat and dog size oxygen masks, restraint and handling aids, reference materials, and contact information for local vet clinics. Without Bart, Smooch and Billy, Kathy Kosnov's Siamese cats, might not be alive today. When a fast-moving fire broke out in the basement of her Minneapolis home 3 years ago, Kosnov and her husband had just minutes to escape, leaving everything, including the cats, behind. Rescuers quickly found Billy, but Smooch was nowhere to be found. Finally, a firefighter emerged carrying a laundry basket with an unresponsive cat inside. Kosnov watched anxiously as the BART-trained firefighter put a tiny oxygen mask on Smooch and performed chest compressions with his fingers, bringing her cherished cat back to life. Though the fire destroyed most of the family's possessions and they couldn't return home for a full year, Kosnov still considers himself lucky. "If we've lost Smooch and Billy, the experience would have been much, much worse," she says. "Thanks to BART, our whole family survived." Currently, Bart is in Minnesota in one fire department in Wisconsin, but Dr. Olson is working to introduce the training program to the other states. Meanwhile, government officials have taken notice. The Bart Basic Animal Life Support class for small animals has been approved by the Department of Homeland Security. Thanks to Dr. Olson and other volunteers, many more rescue workers will have the training to help pets just as they do people. Learning about the organization named for his dog was an emotional experience for Clark, who reflected on the times he himself had been unable to save a family's pet. "It was horrifying for them and for me," he says. "Thanks to Janet, firefighters now have the training to help prevent these tragedies." "Bart was something I had to do," says Dr. Olson, currently a veterinary cardiologist with her own consulting business. "But the program's rewards have been greater than she anticipated. I love being able to make an impact beyond my own practice," she says. One day when an animal saved by a BART-trained personnel arrived at the hospital where Dr. Olson was a cardiology resident, the owner discovered that the program founder worked right down the hall. "She walked up to me and said, 'Thank you for helping me save my pet,'" she says. To see the gratitude in her face was just amazing. And the next article I'm going to read is Cella's Prime Time. And this is an article about Cella Ward, the new star of CSI New York, gets real about second acts, raising teenagers, saying yes to Botox, and why, at 54, she's having the time of her life. Cella Ward is bending over a dead body, looking for an exit wound. As the new star of CSI New York, Ward is doing a lot of that these days. I watch her on the set while she does several takes of the scene. As former FBI agent Joe Danville, she is sleek, savvy, and authoritative. Which is interesting, considering at this very moment, the actress Cella Ward is probably doing everything she cannot do to throw up. "I love it, but this is the hardest job I've ever had," Ward told me a day earlier. "The show was all about our fascination with the different ways people can die. The other day I was in the autopsy lab doing a scene over this fake dead body, and we were trying to determine what tool was used to bash his head in. One of the characters peeled the scalp back, and all this gush came out. It was done so well I couldn't even look at it. I thought I was going to be sick." Ironically, it was the morbid CSI New York that lured the squeamish Ward out of her self-imposed retirement. A few years back, she had quit acting altogether to work on art. She's an accomplished painter, and stay at home with her kids, Austin, now 16, and Annabella, 12. "The kind of roles that were available to me were the uninteresting mother parts," says Ward over lunch in the terrace of her Los Angeles home. "It was so ungratifying, so I decided, fine, I'm not into this. I want to sail away and feel great about what I've accomplished and really focus on my family." and that was fine for a while. Then she noticed that her kids didn't need her around in the way they once did. A few years ago, they were writing sweet things about her, Ward said, and as she shows me one of her son's poems dedicated to the world's greatest mom, which includes lines like, "I'm so glad I popped out of your body," and now that they're at this age where it's like, "Who are you and why are you giving me your opinions?" I was going out of my mind not working, she continues. It was like wandering in a desert. I kept thinking, who am I? What happened to my career? I hadn't realized how much of my identity was wrapped up in what I do. When she got the call from CBS about joining the cast of CSI New York to take over for actress Melina Kenikaridis, who was leaving the show, she was more than ready for a change. And so was the cast for CSI New York, sad as they were to see Kenikaridis go. When Melina left, there wasn't a list of 15 people being considered for the job, says Gary Sinise, Ward's co-star. Cilla was the right choice from the start. She has a cool approach to acting. The writers started crafting the character to what Cilla was bringing to it. Even as a girl growing up in small town Meridian, Mississippi, Cilla Ann Ward seemed destined for showbiz. She was the prom queen at her local high school and a cheerleader for the University of Alabama before she moved to New York City to model in the late 1970s. Stardom came with an Emmy-winning part as the alcoholic Teddy in the 1990s TV series Sisters, followed by another hit drama, Once and Again, in which she played a divorcee looking for love. When her career took off, Ward's romantic life fizzled. There was a broken engagement, reportedly to actor Peter Weller, and a string of dead-end relationships. It wasn't until she was set up on a blind date in 1991 with a handsome, shaggy-haired finance guy named Howard Sherman that Ward met her match. There was just one problem. Sherman is Jewish, and although Ward said she didn't have a fire and brimstone upbringing, her parents did have some concern about her marrying outside her Christian faith. When she became serious about Sherman, she went back to Meridian to visit her pastor. I went to my pastor to talk about this issue, and he said, "Cilla, I think you can find God just as easily in a temple on Friday night as you can in a church on Sunday morning." And I said, "Thank you, I love you, that's what I needed to hear." Today she describes her faith as very spiritually connected to God, whatever God may be, a higher power. I asked Ward the secret to her and Sherman's 18-year reunion. "Therapy," she says without hesitation. "I tell my husband, if we're going to stay married, you and I will both be in therapy. We mostly go separately, but if we're bumping up against an issue, we'll go together. We dump all our stuff there so we don't dump it on each other." "I think everybody has to be in therapy to be truly conscious," Ward says. "It's the only way you're conscious about your behavior and your expectations and your reaction to another person, then that you can really have a healthy relationship." Clearly, awareness and honesty are deeply important to Ward, even when the issue is something as dicey as aging. There isn't one person out there that is over 50, or 47 for that matter, who looks fabulous and hasn't had some help, whatever it is, says Ward, 55. Has she? "Love Botox, love all that stuff. It's the best," she says. "I love all those little things you don't have to cut yourself open for." Not that she's saying no to cosmetic surgery sometime in the future. We have an anatomy to talk about which doctors are the best, but she just happens to be lucky enough not to have needed the facelift yet. Ward is naturally thin, but she eats carefully and works out at least 30 minutes a day. She discovered Gyrotronics, a cousin of Pilates, which she is convinced will help her shed the extra 10 pounds she has gained since breaking her foot last summer. She cracked a bone when she fell wearing platform shoes. "I'm like waddling down the hallway," she says. "No wide-angle lenses for me." With a lunch of chicken salad, pesto bread, and oatmeal cookies dispatched, Ward gives me a tour of her property. It's a soul-soothing place. Tommy Dorsey, a favorite musician of her mother, who died 8 years ago, is playing over the sound system. There is a murmur of water from a man-made stream, and Buddhas are everywhere. Across the lawn is her artist's studio, where the work is sometimes figurative, sometimes abstract, but always pulsing with color and life. Perched on a steep canyon hill is an amphitheater that she has built for family and friends' performances. Ward's son Austin, a talented musician, recently jammed with her CSI New York co-star, Sinise. "When I note that everything is so beautiful, so right, that even the violent bougainvillea seem color-coordinated with the dragonflies," she beams. My home feeds my soul, she says simply. If I were going to have another job other than acting, it would probably be fixing up homes, making them beautiful, and selling them. In fact, she did just that with her last house in 2003, selling it for $12 million to Madonna. Yet Ward admits she has never quite found her true home in California. Her heart is in Meridian, where she and her family return every summer, living on her 500-acre farm, visiting her extended family. Ward's father died in 2009, and friends. Living in Los Angeles, where the show shoots, she admits, can be isolating. I've never had the experience of actresses wanting to be friends, she says. It's such a competitive business, built on illusion. There's little to ground people. I think that's why there's so much loneliness among people here. Ward has talked about eventually moving away from Los Angeles. I asked her what else remains on her bucket list. I'll tell you what it is. It's not a thing I have to do. It's a state I'd like to reach. I just want to be in an emotional space without fear. For all of the self-assuredness and calm that she projects on screen and in life, Ward is actually quite the worrier, and working on CSI New York has fed some of her anxiety. I've started having dreams where people are hunting me down, or my family. And my son just started driving, so I'll think, is he going to have a wreck? Is he going to drink and drive? Is he going to be okay? Am I going to crash in an airplane? The list goes on and forever. And it only get worse with my daughter, so that's what I want, in just some time, and to live without fear. And as a sidebar, Sela gives back. Years ago, Ward had a holiday tradition of dropping off presents for kids at a local Mississippi shelter. One time, she met two young brothers who had been removed from their home because of an abusive father. Those boys had been through hell, she has said, but they still had such promise in their faces. The encounter inspired her to open Hope Village for Children in Mississippi in 2000, where neglected kids aren't just housed and given the medical treatment they need, but also taught life skills. The center is funded half by the state and half by private funds. We've had some great success stories. Some of our kids have become honor roll students, says Ward. We help them get back on their feet. To learn more about Hope Village for Children, go to hopevillagems.org. And again, that's hopevillagems.org. And it looks like that we have run out of time for today's episode of From Soup to Nuts. I hope you listen again next time, and I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Missy Hollander, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. And again, this is the Ladies' Home Journal, the December-January issue. And so long until next time. Thank you.